This came, I'm actually really new to Australia, so I'm a big immigrant. I arrived in Australia in 2001, but I arrived in Broome in 2006. So before I get to 2006 when I arrived in Broome, maybe just a bit of a snippet in 2001 and 6, it's the fact that I stayed and lived in Sydney within that time, and I studied at University of New South Wales doing my architecture degree. So it came a point where I was, as an international student, I was doing all sorts of odd jobs, and one of the jobs was working at the Australian Geographic Store. And when I met a family, happened that I got on well with their kids, so they invited me to do a bit of a babysitting gig. So I took that up, thinking like, yay, I've got my fourth job now. It's going to be, you know, all right to pay off some debts and whatnot. And, you know, the living standards and all that. So a few months later, they invited me to Broome. They said, look, we've got a house in Broome. We'd love for you to come and look after the kids while we do the socials. Look, I don't really, you know all that, but I thought, wow, you know, they can bring me over to Broome, which I don't know where Broome was at that time. I said, yes, it was during term break, and I had the opportunity to go somewhere else, and someone's paid for it, and I'm like, right. So landed in Broome. It was supposed to be a two-week holiday. By the third day, I thought, oh, gosh, you know, all I saw was the house and the sand dune, and I didn't really get to go anywhere. But they had a little scooter, I got on a scooter. Broome was very different. Just to show again, has anyone been to Broome? Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. But the rest of you, bucket list. You have to go to Broome because that's your gateway to the rest of the Kimberley, which I'll touch on a little bit about why there as well. So what happened was I landed there and then realized that I got on the scooter, went around, I didn't see much, and got to a cafe. Sat there, ordered my coffee. And the lady came and chatted to me, and she started telling me a little bit about herself and her background. And I'm just going to reflect back on that conversation for those who are here for Jenna's talk and Jenna's dad as well. That whole Broome experience, it's really, really invigorating because this lady that I was having coffee with, actually, she told me her background. She said, oh, she's Japanese, and she was Japanese mixed, Aboriginal mixed, Scottish mixed, Chinese. It blew my mind because I think at that point I realized that I know absolutely nothing about Australia. Because I was there on holiday and I lived in Sydney. My world was only what I thought I knew. So you know when you thought you knew something, but you don't really know anything. So I went to Broome, I realized that I really absolutely know nothing. It was just this tiny grain of sand and this big, you know, long beach and nothing. So I think that was the turning point that I realized that that's where I want to be, because I found a different narrative of belonging, because there's that little similarity. And she started telling me that, oh, Park Din over there, he's from India, he's from Malaysia, he's dying to speak to someone who lives, you know, who knows how to speak Bahasa. So I think that connection of food and language just encapsulated and drew me in to the idea of what living in Broome could be. So I think that narrative of being in a different world for me at that time was really far from Broome to Sydney. Was really appealing. But my folks were so angry at me because to them, metropolitan or cities, it's where you grow, it's where you make your money, it's where you thrive. And I think I'm proving them wrong because I've lived in Broome for 20 years now. And I think I'm all right now. It's pretty okay. Well, one of the jobs that I had in Broome was I was in the education sector, so I was working at TAFE. And working in TAFE for the visual arts department has given me a lot more opportunities and opened the gates for me to travel to different remote parts of the Western Australia. One of them is very close, like within the Kimberley. When I say close, it's like the closest is probably 2 hours down, 2 hours drive down the road. And it can go up to about 6 to 8 hours. Which Sally has recently traveled around the Kimberley.
There's no easy feat.
Oh no. Yeah. If you can get your one material, you're done. That you really have to be so super organized, not tools that you're about to bring. Anyway, when I travel to different parts of the remote community, and that's another realization that I realized, I also know nothing. So in the life cycle that I have in the last 20 years, it's constantly reaching these borders and these boundaries and these invisible gates, because you're constantly learning about new things and you're constantly, you know, being bombarded with another new awareness. So I think that part of me and moving to Broome, lots of people have asked me about, so do you think this is going to be the rest of your life living in Broome? I say, absolutely. Because if it wasn't for Broome, I feel like the narrative I work wouldn't have been this way. It wouldn't have actually, you know, embodied me or even molded me in being the artist that I am today. So the Broome factor was a huge factor, but also living regionally was a huge factor. Because I also realized that a lot of my peers that live regionally, we have similar, you know, disadvantages or difficulties as well. And then recently, I just arrived from Coco's Killing. Also, I'm not sure anyone been to Coco's Killing. Bucket list, everyone, Coco's Killing. So another part of Western Australia that is almost like a forgotten island. So this is another world that I've just been to recently and realized that a lot of people don't know about Coco's Killing. It is part of two islands, one is the home island and the west island, and the west side are the home island. It has 600 community members that live there. They are Muslim communities. And they are so far away from what we know as Australia that we even need to actually fill out all the declarations hard when we enter in play. So that's the fact. And the fact that they have WA postcode and phone number, but we still have to go through international gates and we still have to declare everything when we go through. So, but they vote within the North Territory electorate. So this is how remote and how little I feel sometimes when I traverse between borders or even, let me say, the gates of trying to know my neighbours, trying to get to know the community that I engage with. Yeah.
I think, you know, your work really talks about memory and keeping that alive, but also in the other work that you do with community and, you know, on Hopeless, but also within Aboriginal community and art centres, it is also really about keeping alive their culture and enabling them to be able to extend their practices, but also, I guess, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about why you're on the Crocus, because I feel like that is quite important as well, like the...
Like on the Crocus?
Butty Revive.
Oh, yes. Well, it's a similar thread as well. So I work with lots of different art centres, mainly with the Peabody in WA, the Aboriginal Art Centre, Hub WA. I think that's sort of the reason why they contracted me with a lot of different gigs, I should say, is from my background of the education sector. So I think when it came to that point, I realized that the skills, I mean, it's not new. A lot of the skills that we do, it's just to repeat it or refine or reinvent, but also engage you with communities in ways that they can tell the stories. So I'm not teaching them to tell your stories, but they're telling stories like I'm showing various ways of how you can achieve that. So I think that skill share, I learn the most every time I walk away. I learn the most. I feel like that's the most I've learned. I mean, I selfishly think, oh my gosh, I think I got a lot out of this. But I think it's very much about that realization on that language that we share. It's not just the spoken language, the language of food, the language of our identity, the language of the disparities that we feel, the language of isolation, and the language of being a woman, a mother, an Asian descendant, but also understanding each other's predicament of where we are. So in Coco's itself, there was once a thriving party industry where now the community, the older communities, has just moved on because it's really house law. Show hands, anyone done party before? Yes. So you totally understand that it's that whole process. It's process driven, but also depending on the colors that you want to do. So the younger generations that, so they go about by the older generation and the meat generation. It's now a lot of them has gone to move to Perth for work, but they've come back to raise their family. And Coco's is just absolutely beautiful. I don't think I've ever really seen anything like that aside from Broome occasionally. But the kids at about 4:30, they're out roaming and they're playing and you hear giggles. And I walk past it, big Jackie Chan! It's not the real name, but I get it. So we're screaming and yelling and just having fun. And Greg was there, my husband was there, and they taught us how to do this bocha dance in the middle of the street. Everyone drives a buggy. I'm painting this picture. You have to go now. but then also, when it comes to the younger generation, no one really understands what that is aside from just looking at the remnants of what their grandparents has done. So that workshop was really trying to engage with them in that language of what it could be, you know, what it was for them, but also introducing innovative techniques through seal painting, because it's all about resisting, you know, drawing resist lines and putting colors in, and seal painting, and then slowly moving on to wax, and perhaps what you could do with cold wax on the fabric as well. So I think it sort of invigorated that idea, even for the older generations, in terms of, oh, maybe we can adopt that, we can go back to that. And this is an intergenerational project where it's not just for the, you know, adults, but it's also for kids. And gosh, boy, you know, they worked me hard. I went through from school to school, and every single class from every single year except for weekend day. So I felt like I was doing a performance every day.
Yeah, seeing all the photos, it was so amazing. And I think everything embodies the work that you work in a reciprocal manner. Like, yes. I've worked alongside you as a facilitator before, and yeah, I feel very like proud to work alongside you because of the way that you work, and it's always a co-learning experience. And I think going back to your work, especially the front part, the amazing silk tassels in that part, and you're able to go and learn from a master dyer on that.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yes.
Experience and what I got to do through Instagram, and people be like, oh wow, this is great, Jackie.
So early this year, I received funding from the Department of Culture Industries, now we call it NWA, to learn from the master dyer and master weaver in Laos. So I came across that through another friend who was an apprentice to the master dyer. Her name is Simone Sensei. She lives in Sydney very well. Oh, no, Canberra. She lives in Canberra. Anyway, so she was running a workshop. We extended to me to go to Laos, and I finally got it. What I didn't know when I got there was that when I heard about her stories and why she wanted to do this, it's very much about reviving the textile industry, but also revive that narrative. It was at one point the women in Laos were only making these fabrics, only solely for their own purpose. It was never for a commercial. It was for their wedding gown. So because it takes, gosh, many, many hours. We're talking from scratch, like literally watching the silkworms doing the thing all the way to actually, you know, light it and getting all the silk threads and then picking the plants all naturally from the environment and dyeing it, and then getting onto the loom, the traditional loom, and making a fabric. And that's just making the fabric before you actually make an entire costume or entire wear. So I found that incredibly fascinating because it was women's work. It was entirely about intergenerational women's work. So women, that I found that young girls, they learn at the age of 3 or 5, whenever they were young enough to sit inside their grandmother hand or their mother to learn how to actually weave. I found that, like, I was a bit FOMO. I was jealous because I didn't have that with my mother. It was a different generation as well, and it was a different context of where we live. So from there, all these silk threads, it blew my mind that the colors are all naturally from the environment. The yellow, the really brilliant yellow, was the monk color in their fabric that they wore, to Manato seeds. And every plant in the dub, you had to go down to the farm and where the cows were and dig into next to the cow dung. It's like, whoa, should I be declaring this? I'll get to a farm. And then dug a hole and put my dyes in there. I put my threads in there and cover it, and remember to put a stick, because when you come back, you might not know where to go. So learn about that. And those colors were really, really brilliant, but also wasn't just that. It was how hardworking these women were in terms of navigating the skills and organizational ways in terms of what you do next after another. So when I wanted to do the tassels, it was very much about paying homage to my family in terms of lucky charms. I grew up with lots of individual lucky charms, and I just couldn't. I remember looking at all this and I'm like, oh, there's a lucky charm. But now I see it in a different light. because I really appreciate the idea of what these individual threads come from. And from silk, I mean, literally watching how it grew. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the organizational, is very much the way that you work. You come from an architectural lens, I mean, to make the gate, and from the many pieces of paper that, like, not even that paper, like the paper that you planned it all on and sent through, like, it's very much an organizational and architectural lens that you work in, which is great for a curator.
Yeah.
You know, like, all of these immaculate PDFs of how we're going to put it together and which layer is what, and it was like, I was like, oh my god, I didn't even
see the hardware on his
I didn't even see that PDF. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, going on from that, the actual manual labor of then doing the rest of the game as well, like, let's talk about that, because...
Yeah. So the entire gate was formulated from the context of me traversing in different environments and different borders, seeing everywhere we felt. So I really wanted the audience of the patrons to catch the idea of how it feels or what it means to actually traverse through different borders. So I looked at each individual layers as my whole personal history of walking through different terrains and getting to know different people. But I wanted the, I mean, I'm not forcing this against, onto patrons. That's why we have a little gap on the side. Because I feel like each layer, as you walk through, I'm hoping you would have felt a little bit in, envelope between, within this space, and also the experience of actually walking through, a real experience of walking through a tunnel or different layers of life. So it wasn't like, and also the idea of gate, but we've all been to Chinatown. We've seen that the iconic gate, and that's a real iconic way of actually knowing, oh yeah, that's a gate, that's Chinatown. But a lot of places that I go, they don't have gates like that. I know going to Hobart, there was a Chinatown, because I was looking for that sort of, you know, that some sort of a landmark and go, ah, that's my mom over there, that's where I can get Chinese food, or, you know, Chinese grocery. But I realized a lot of places don't have that. So the layers of papers, the paper itself is Shuan paper, purposely wanted to actually use the Chinese paper. And one of the things that really, that I wanted to showcase was the, according to my mom, is badly written Chinese calligraphy. I didn't think it was that bad. According to her. But she helped me out as well. So she was demonstrating to me how to write these words and these characters. As she was writing, she was telling me the words for each stroke. So building, talking about architecture, building these characters is like architectural building. Mm. She was like, Pie and Hun and this. And I was like, oh my God, I'm just having to remember what she's saying. But the funny thing is, although I don't read or write Chinese, I learned it when I was a very, very young young girl. But I actually somehow understood how the strokes were. Mm-hmm. And I could look at the character, I could tell, like, it starts with this, and it starts with left to right, and it starts with that, and it goes on and on. So when I started writing it, in her own words, she felt that this is the translation. She says, I'm vomiting blood watching you do this. It was so dreadful for her. So then I learned that whole idea of what she was trying to say. Every character, everything that everyone has done, yeah, this is a staunch Chinese sculpture. Every single line has a story.
Mm.
Every single stroke and every pressure, the way you lift, the way you place, and the way you actually absorb the ink into the brush. Everything has a meaning. And I think after doing 1,110 layers of this, I think it didn't look too bad, you know? It didn't look pretty awesome to me, but, you know. But I realized what she was really trying to say is understanding where you come from in your home. So these characters are not just random characters. They are a poetry from Li Bai, a Chinese poet that recites about home about, you know, wherever I go, I should always remember home. So I wrote this with my mom repeatedly on sheets of paper until I got better in my understanding. And I feel like the more I wrote about it, the more I'm proud of where I come from. And I'm also proud that I got to meet all my neighbors within, you know, the Kimberley or everywhere that I go. And an incredibly humbling experience, because as an individual, as an immigrant who's new in Australia, I'm arrived in 2001, I'm still learning and I don't know everything, not possibly. So also speaking on what, you know, Jenna's dad, Brian. Not Brian.
No?
Is it Brian?
Chris.
Oh my God, how did I get Brian? I'm so sorry. Chris. They mentioned about, you know, back in 1901 and to what policy. Broome was exempted from the white policy, so there was a lot of indentured workers. And getting to know some of them, telling their stories, and I realized that I live in this part of the world. I hear their stories, but I don't share the same sentiments because I come from a different, you know, place. And all I could do is just listen and understand that context. But I'm not repeating their stories, but I'm also narrating my own story and weaving that narrative into the work that I do, but understanding my surrounding wherever I go. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's been such a pleasure to work with you and see all of this unfold. And yeah, I'm not sure if everyone caught, but there is 1,110 individual strips of paper in this work that all got
waxed as well.
Waxed, hand waxed, that all got hung individually. But I guess you have one last offering.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Shall we end on that note?
Yes, I think that would be wonderful. So, I did mention that I don't write or read Chinese. For this poetry, this poem, my mom taught me since I was a very young girl that was going to kindergarten. She made me recite every single morning before I leave for school, to a point that I can articulate and recite so perfectly. But it wasn't until this project that I learned how to write it. So it was such a different process. So here's the
first. Again,
I'm going to put the mic down.
Because there's a chance.
Is that all they
Okay. So this is what I have to do.
床前明月光，疑是地上霜。举头望明月，低头西湖香。
So that was the poetry.
Does anyone have any questions?
Yay, I've got a question. Thank you so much for sharing about how you wound up in drawing and about your calligraphy classes with your mom. I could really connect to it because I too am not a fluent reader or writer of Chinese, but I have a history with my father of calligraphy, so I really appreciated this story. So I wanted to ask you what it was like for you to then cut that work up that you'd done in that mailbox. What that meant for you doing instruction.
To cut it out of work.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's something that I thought about. I didn't think that would be a question, but I didn't think about that. So when I cut all this up and rearranged it, it was very much about, it reflects about me, as a lot of it, because I live in this transient world that I'm neither this nor that. So I think that Chinese character sort of reflects me because according to my mom, I'm Chinese, but not Chinese enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in Australia, but I'm not Australian. So I traverse in this world and then constantly in between. Like I know a little, but I don't know a little. So cutting up the work, really, like someone comes on, of course, I don't know if I'm obviously, but someone actually came to me and said to me last night, I say, I could read and find out the words. Is this something about moon and something about a childhood poetry? And I said, you picked it because that individual could read, the characters. And I think by putting it, you know, in a sporadic way, it really captures me because I'm neither this way. It's constantly other way. Like learning to speak English is hard enough. Like just a little side joke. When I first came to Australia, I was at the UNSW outside bus stop. Someone walked past me and said, how are you going? And I went by bus. That's how I mean, when I learned English back in Malaysia, it was, hello, how are you? I'm very well, thank you. I didn't come across, hey, how are you going?
Yeah,
didn't understand that term. But that was just, you know, one little part. And I'm still learning that because every part, everywhere I go in different communities, and I'll try to learn it too. Words of everyone I meet, like if I know we're from different contexts, a different continent or a different place, I try to learn something. Like this morning, I learned Xinqiao. And here, and when I go to remote communities, I learn a little bit of Wamajari, a bit of Parajari, and a bit of, you know, Ngangomara. So when I meet the people, I have one thing to share with them to start off. So that's my preaching. That's my way of, you know, opening myself and saying, yeah, I'm here to, I'm willing to learn, I'm here to listen. So yeah. I hope that answers. Sorry, it's a long-winded one.
So I don't know if you already did, Jack. And that poem you recited sounded so beautiful with all the intonations up and down. But can you translate it into English?
good one. I can say it very quickly. Synopsis, what it means. It just means like. I hope I'm right. Okay. When you are lonely and at home, yeah, in a place, and you think about home, you open your window and you look up and find the moon, because the moon, the luna, is it's a very powerful source. You find the moon, and when you look up the moon, you always remember where you're from, where your home is. But when you look down, you never forget what you just saw and where your home is. So that's what it happens.
Any more socials, or can we give a little?